Sabbath, everyone. Dilly-dally. That was a big word in my family. My dad used that all the time. That meant we weren't just fooling around. We weren't doing what we were supposed to be doing. Welcome to everybody that's on the webcast and visitors. We do have some visitors, one in particular back there that we haven't seen for a while, Ben Bradley. Hope you'll go back and see him. I think a lot of people know Ben. So I want to start by reading a very familiar but important set of scriptures. We've heard these quite often. 2 Timothy 3, verses 16 and 17. Paul says to Timothy, "All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work." You want to bring up the slides? So why do I start with this? Well, if you're like me, as you read through the Bible, there are certain areas that you come to where you kind of make a conscious decision to skip over it. And genealogies may be one. They can be kind of boring. Not boring, but there's not something you want to really delve into a lot of times. Another could be the Old Testament description of the offerings that are in the first few chapters of Leviticus. But Paul says here that all scriptures comes from God and is valuable. So today I want to go over into a section that might be one of those that you generally skip over or just read through quickly. Don't go into much detail. It's found in the book of Exodus, but after the story of Moses, it's after the story of Moses and the actual Exodus account, and it's past the giving of God's laws and his statutes. So today, let's look at what God told Moses, how he told Moses to build in the Exodus, that is, the tabernacle. And we're going to go into some of the details and see what lessons we can take from the descriptions that we find in primarily Exodus. It's in a couple other places as well, but primarily in Exodus. But more importantly, we're going to find out the very purpose of the tabernacle and how it relates to salvation. And what it showed about Jesus Christ himself. And I forgot to set this, so let me do that real quick. Now I'm going to use some slides as we go along here that hopefully will make it a little bit clearer, make the vision of it a little bit clearer. And it shows what God was doing and the design that we find in the tabernacle and that he gave to the children of Israel. I do want to acknowledge as I begin this message that I obtained some very good information from a four-part Bible study that was given by Mr. Roy Holiday back in 2002, and also from the UCG Bible commentary that you can find online. Both of those are available. You might avail yourselves of seeing those. So turn over to the book of Exodus, and we'll start in Exodus 25, and we're going to spend most of our time, as I said, in the book of Exodus. Now, just a little bit of background in the time frame as we get into the subject of the tabernacle. As we start in chapter 25, the people had left Egypt a couple of months earlier. They came to Mount Sinai and they received the Ten Commandments from God himself. He spoke directly to the people, as you remember. Then God spoke to Moses, giving him some statutes and judgments. And those Moses recited to the people because by that time they were a little bit afraid of hearing God's voice. And finally they agreed to obey God and they ratified the covenant with blood. And shortly after, God called Moses up to the mountain, Mount Sinai, to give him more instructions. And that's where we're going to begin in chapter 25. So I think I've already missed one. Let's see. And my title today is The Tabernacle More Than Meets the Eye. Exodus 25, and I'll read a couple verses from this section. I aren't going to read too many verses because we're going to have to move through this fairly quickly. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel that they bring me an offering. From everyone who gives it willingly with his heart, you shall take my offering." Now, what kind of offering does God want from the people? You know, in a lot of places, it's bulls and goats and sheep. But that's not what he's looking for here. He's actually looking for something else. He says, and this is the offering which you shall take from them, gold, silver, bronze, blue, purple, scarlet thread, fine linen, and goat's hair, ram skins dyed red, badger skins, and acacia wood, oil for the light, and spices for the anointing oil and for the sweet incense, onyx stones and stones to be set in the ephod and in the breastplate. Those were actually clothing, items of clothing the high priest would wear. So these are not what we commonly expect the people to give as an offering. And what are these materials for? Well, he answers that in the next verse, slide 5, if I can keep up with my notes here. And let them make me a sanctuary, that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so you shall make it. So God was going to provide a pattern, a design, of a place that he would dwell in among the people. Was there any significance to this design? Did it represent something? Well, notice what Paul said hundreds of years later about the tabernacle. It's in two verses I'll read. Hebrews 8:5. He's speaking about the priests that served in the tabernacle. Hebrews 8:5 says, who serve, speaking of these priests, the copy and shadow of the heavenly things, as Moses was divinely instructed when he was about to make the tabernacle. For he said, see that you make all things according to the pattern shown you on the mountain. So God actually displayed to him, we don't know exactly the details of how he did that, whether he gave him a paper with a drawing on it or he made a vision of somehow. In Hebrews 9:23 it says, therefore it was necessary that the copies of the things in heaven should be purified with these, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these. So what God revealed to Moses on Sinai was to be a copy of what was in heaven. The tabernacle represented a copy and a shadow of what is already in heaven. And as we proceed through this message, we're going to see how these are a shadow of what's in heaven. So besides being a copy and a shadow of what's in heaven, as we just read, what was the purpose? What did God have in mind when he gave this information about the tabernacle? Well, one purpose is found in Exodus 29, verses 45 and 46. Let's see if I'm keeping up. Oh, I'm going the wrong way. Those are the two verses I just read, and here we are now. Exodus 29:45, for I will dwell among the children of Israel, and I will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord their God, who brought them up out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord their God. So God intended to be with the Israelites and to actually dwell in their midst. The tabernacle would be the place in which God actually met the people of Israel. The tabernacle was to be the point of contact with his appointed leaders, of course, beginning with Moses. And additionally, there were actions that would take place in the tabernacle that had some very important meanings in them. And we'll see even more of that purpose as we move through this message. Now, in a few minutes, we'll get into the details of the construction of the tabernacle, the holy place, the outer court, and the individual components and activities that were so important to its functioning. But first, I want to show you some views of what the completed tabernacle may have looked like. These are obviously artist's rendering based on descriptions that we're going to look at in a few minutes. And you see the layout, and we'll go into details on those. And the prominent place in there is the building up to the upper center. Here's another view, same thing, and here's another view. These are all artist rendering because no one actually has photos, obviously, of what the tabernacle looked like, but we have pretty good descriptions of what was to go into it, although it's not as minute as you might expect. Okay, now what about the size of the tabernacle? Here's a diagram of what the tabernacle looked like. The width of it, one side to the other, was 75 feet. The length, it was rectangular. The length was 150 on either side, so it was a perfect rectangle. There was a courtyard. There was a fence delineating the the tabernacle and a courtyard in the center, and then the tent of meeting we saw there in a minute ago. Now, to get a perspective of what size this would be, compare it to an American football field. That's what a football field is composed of, 100 yards with end zones on each side. And the tabernacle is roughly half of what that 100-yard section would be, and roughly half going into the center of the field. So you could almost fit four tabernacles into a full-size American football field. So let's finish up with the dimensions of the tabernacle. I've left out all the important components that made up the vital activities and just shown here the tent of meeting, also called the sanctuary. The tent of meeting had two enclosed sections. It sat to the west side of the outer court, and there were two sections in it. Both, this is one building, and these two sections were inside. You have the holy place on the right and the Holy of Holies that's on the left. The Holy of Holies, and of course they gave all the dimensions in the Bible in terms of cubits. I've just translated it into what we think a cubit translates to in terms of inches and feet. So it was about, in the Holy of Holies, you had a room that was roughly 15 by 15. It was square. In the holy place, you had one that was 15 wide and 30 feet long. So altogether, that tabernacle building was 45 feet long. Now, God told Moses that the entire construction of the tabernacle had to be of the highest quality and workmanship. In fact, he even designated the individuals that he wanted to oversee and perform some of the work. Exodus 31, 1 through 6, to give some of that information. He says, "Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying," this is Exodus 31, verse 1, "See, I have called by name Bezaleel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur, of the tribe of Judah. And I filled him with the Spirit of the Lord, Spirit of God, in wisdom, in understanding, in knowledge, and in all manner of workmanship, in artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze, in cutting jewels for settings, in carving wood, and to work in all manner of workmanship. And I, have appointed with him Oholiab, the son of Ahisamach, of the tribe of Dan, and I have put wisdom in the hearts of the gifted artisans, that they may make all that I have commanded you." So in the New Testament, we're given gifts by God, but in this particular case, God chose two individuals and gave them extra His Spirit in terms of being able to come up with designs and workmanship that would meet the quality standards that God had in mind when He built this, or when this was to be built. Now let's look at a couple more important features or components of the tabernacle. So we have these major components. We have the outer wall. We'll go into details on these in a few minutes. We had an entrance gate. It's on the east side of the tabernacle. We have an altar of burnt offerings, also called a brazen altar. It was in the courtyard, along with the bronze laver that was in the courtyard. Then going into the building, and we'll go into more details in each of these, there was three items in the holy place. That's the first room: the table of showbread, the lampstand, and an altar of incense. And then inside the Holy of Holies was the ark and the mercy seat. Now here's a detailed layout of the tabernacle showing these main components. Again, just a diagram. We saw before the layout, but here's where each of these components were. You had the entrance gate, which was always on the east, the altar of burnt offerings, or the graven altar, the bronze laver. Inside the first room, you had the golden lampstand, table of showbread, altar of incense, and then going into the Holy of Holies, which we'll see later on, the only person that could go into the Holy of Holies was the high priest, and that only once a year. So those are the major components. Now, to begin with, let's notice the tabernacle complex, as we see there, is surrounded with a kind of a fence. Moses was told what this would consist of in Exodus 27. So let's move there. There's again an artist rendering of what this fence around the buildings and all the accoutrements inside might have looked like. And you also notice that this gate here, and this I found several different drawings, and they don't know exactly how this gate was situated. This one has it offset a little bit from the entrance, so you kind of walk around it. Others had it right there across the opening, where to go in you just kind of move the veil out of the way, or the entranceway out of the way. So they're not totally sure exactly how this was situated. So let me read some information about this. Exodus 27, verse 9, "You shall also make the court of the tabernacle. For the south side there shall be hangings for the court, made of fine woven linen." So that's what we have here. All the outside here is fine woven linen. 100 cubits long for one side. So as we said, that's 150 feet. And its 20 pillars and its 20 sockets shall be bronze. The hooks of the pillars and the bands shall be silver. So what he's talking about here is the actual connections that are going into these posts, and we'll look at that in a little bit more detail in a minute. So the north and the south of this side of this fence surrounding the courtyard was made up of very high quality linen that had been woven by these craftsmen. They were held up by pillars or posts, as we see, and there was 20 on each of the two long sides, 10 on the end side. And the shorter side on the west had the same curtains and the posts, but again, only 10 posts. And verse 8 says that the height would be 5 cubits, so that's 7.5 feet tall all around. Well, that's enough so that the average Israelite was not going to be able to see inside what was going on. God did not intend it to be viewed by the people. However, we saw a moment ago the entrance to the tabernacle was always on the east side. So on the east, there was a slightly different configuration, and you see right here they only have three posts there, and then four in the middle. So it's still 10, but they're broken into 3, 4, and 3. The entrance gate in the middle had four posts, as I said, and three posts on either side. This is described in chapter 27 in verses 14 and 15. Now here's two more views of this fence. That's a close-up of it. And then long ways. Now let's focus for a moment on this gate that we just talked about, the one that's off. Oop, hit the wrong button. The one that's offset. This here. This is the gate, and you see in this view, whoever designed it believed that that curtain, that gate, was straight across rather than being offset. Exodus 27:16, "For the gate of the court there shall be a screen 20 cubits long, woven of blue, purple, and scarlet thread, and fine woven linen made by a weaver. And it shall have four pillars and four sockets." So it wasn't composed of white linen like the rest of the fence around the outside, but it was quite colorful. And let's see. And here's another view of what it could have looked like. They don't know exactly what the design was. So regarding the colors, God did say that there were to be four colors in this gate. And each of these had a symbolic meaning. It was purple was to be incorporated, scarlet, white, and blue. Well, the purple represented the color of kings. Scarlet often represented blood and sacrifice. White is the color associated with purity. And blue is thought to represent the color of the heaven and divinity. So now let's turn to the important items that God said to place inside the courtyard of the tabernacle. There were two items, as we saw a few minutes ago. The first one is the brazen altar. It's described in Exodus 27:1. It says, "You shall make an altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits long and 5 cubits wide. The altar shall be square, and its height shall be 3 cubits. So the height of this altar is 7.5 feet wide and long, and 4.5 feet tall. You shall make an altar of acacia. I just read that. You shall make its horns on the four corners, and its horn shall be one piece with it, and you shall overlay it with bronze. So a lot of the items in the center of the courtyard, including this, had bronze on it. And when we go into the actual tabernacle, we'll see there's different metals. Verse 3, you shall make its pans to receive its ashes, and its shovels, and its basins, and its forks, and its fire pans. You shall make all those utensils of bronze. You shall make a grate for it, a network of bronze, on the network you shall make four rings at the four corners. So you see, the rings are built into several of these items, and therefore the purpose of being carried when the tabernacle building need to be transferred. The poles shall be put in the rings, and the poles shall be on the two sides of the altar to bear it. So as you enter the tabernacle courtyard, the very first thing you're going to see is this bronze altar. And it's made of fine wood, again covered with bronze. On this altar, the priests handled burnt offerings that were brought by the people. And there's a rendering of what the priests were doing and had to do. And another view of the altar. And you notice here are charcoal and burning embers that had to be constantly fed to keep it going. And if you remember a message I gave a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, about two high priests, sons of Aaron, that failed to take the fire from this altar. They apparently got it from somewhere else, and God struck them down because they were not doing what they were told to have done. Leviticus 6:13 says that the flames in this altar were to be kept burning at all times. Now, a bronze grate was placed in the middle of the altar to handle the wood that to keep it burning and to allow ash to fall below the altar where it was ultimately collected. Now, two of the prominent features are the horns that extend from the upper corners, as you can see there, and the rings that accommodate the wooden pole, so it can be carried. Now, the next item in the courtyard is the bronze laver. And Moses is given information about this laver in Exodus 30, verses 18 to 21. He says, "You shall make a laver of bronze with its base also of bronze for washing. You shall put it between the tabernacle of meeting and the altar, and you shall put water in it." So what purpose did that serve? Well, it's quite simple. Verse 19, "For Aaron and his sons shall wash their hands and their feet in water from it. When they go into the tabernacle of meeting, or when they come near to the altar to minister, to burn an offering made by fire to the Lord, they shall wash with water, lest they die." So this had symbolic meaning, washing symbolically their sins. Now we've traversed through the tabernacle courtyard. Let's now come to the building itself. Now here's a rendition of the building. Again, we talked about there being two sides inside the building, the holy place and the holy of holies, but they're all in one structure. But let's quickly look at how the building was constructed. As with all the other parts of the building, God gave Moses a very intricate detail about how this should be built. Exodus 26, we'll start in verse 15. "And for the tabernacle you shall make boards of acacia wood." Again, acacia wood was a very strong and light wood that was found in the Middle East. And virtually all of the wooden part of the tabernacle was made with acacia wood. 10 cubits shall be the length of the board, and a cubit and a half shall be the width of the board. So these boards, which made the poles, you'll see outside the courtyard was 7.5. But inside the building, you had holy pillars and then most holy pillars, depending on which part of the building it was in. And these are both 15 feet high. Now continuing verse 17, it gets into some detail here about God, what God said to do in order to make this thing structurally sound. 2 tenons shall be in each board for binding one to another. Thus you shall make for all the boards of the tabernacle. And you shall make the boards for the tabernacle, 20 boards for the south side. You shall make 40 sockets of silver under the 20 boards. two sockets under each of the boards for its two tenons. So this is going to fit together. And let's see if I can get this. These are roughly how the boards and the posts would fit together. You see, there's actually... These are upright boards, and they have holes in it. So in the middle, the very center, there's a bar that goes through, keeping them structurally together. But there's tenons that go at the bottom, and they fit into sockets. And the bottom, these sockets are made out of silver. At the top, one board connects to the other with a ring. So it was rather extensive and very solid when it was put together, and they had to have these craftsmen who carefully carved all these things. Now, you recall some of those items that the Israelites were asked to donate. Among those were goat hair, skins of rams and badgers, and linen. And those went on to the covering of the outside of the tabernacle. These included first was badger skin, and then ram skin that they dyed red, goat's hair, which was basically white, and then linen that had a cherubim design on it. And then in the front of it, there was another screen that had a design in it as well. These went all on top, with the exception of the screen. These all laid on top of the tabernacle building. Again, they included a large veil of linen, again having blue, scarlet, and purple. And in this particular veil, there was a design of an angel, a cherubim that was woven into it. In the front door of the tabernacle was the screen we just showed there. It's also of linen, and it has the same four colors we talked about a few minutes ago. I said earlier that the courtyard, most of the metallic components in that courtyard were bronze. But when we come now to the tabernacle, nearly all of the interior items, the boards, the bars, the pillars that we just showed as construction of it, they're all overlaid with gold. Only the sockets at the bottom of those boards were made from silver. And we'll see even greater use of gold when we get to the Holy of Holies. But now let's look once more at the layout of the tabernacle building as we enter from the courtyard. So you'd enter this way through the courtyard and then through that veil into the holy place. And inside this room we have three items. We have the candlestick, the table of showbread, and the altar of incense. We're going to cover those in a little bit more detail in a moment. First, let's take note of an important subject. Just who can enter into this building? After all, the entire complex is holy to God. So who can enter into the building? Well, in the outer section, only Levites and priests could go in. And priests were assigned certain duties. But inside the building, Levites couldn't go. You had to be a priest. And then, as you know, the inside of the Holy of Holies, only the high priest at that moment. Now, another look at the tabernacle building we see in 32. Let me go forward to that. Okay, so that's a little bit of a cutout showing the various sections. There's a veil going across here. So this is the holy place and the Holy of Holies. And again, you can see it goes up to this point, and then that curtain goes across. Let's see, where was I? So in the courtyard, or the outer court, were allowed, again, Levites were allowed to be in the courtyard if they had assigned duties, and Levitical priests. But then again, going into the tabernacle in the holy place, only priests, and then only the holy priest. The high priest, I should say. Now let's look at the items in more detail in that first room in the Holy of Holies. First, we have the golden lampstand. It's described in Exodus 25:31. God says, "You shall make a lampstand of pure gold. The lampstand shall be hammered work, its shafts, its branches, its bowls, its ornamental knobs, and flowers shall be all of one piece. So you see this, got to take some real craftsmanship to construct these and carve these. And six branches shall come out of its side, three branches on the lampstand of one side, three on the other side. Three bowls shall be made like almond blossoms on one branch, an ornamental knob and a flower, and three bowls made like almonds on the outer branch, and an ornamental knob and flower, and so for the six branches that come out of the lampstand. Verse 37, you shall make seven lamps for it, and they shall arrange its lamps so that they give light in front of it, and its wick trimmers and the trays shall be of pure gold. It shall be made of a talent of pure gold with all these utensils. So a talent may have weighed as much as 70 pounds. Now the craftsman carved this lampstand from one piece of gold and then had gold used for these other ornamental features that are on it. And inside the holy place, the lampstand, as you might have figured, was the only source of illumination. Now, it had a lot of symbolic meaning, as did the items that were in the tabernacle. We'll talk about these in just a few minutes. So the next item was the table of showbread. Moses was told in Exodus 25:23, you shall make a table of acacia wood, again the same wood, 2 cubits its height, a cubit its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold, and make a molding of gold all around. And you shall make for it 4 rings of gold, and put the rings on the 4 corners that are at the 4 legs. These rings shall be close to the frame as holders for the poles to bear the table. And you shall set the showbread on the table before me always. So again, gold was used to cover the wood that was making up this table. The table was 3 feet long by 1.5 feet wide by roughly 27 inches high. Now Leviticus 24:8-9 states that the bread was made from a very distinct recipe. And in 1 Chronicles 9:32 it explains that the sons of Kohath had the task of preparing the bread every week. And the bread was to be used only by the high priest and his sons. Next we come to the altar of incense. And the last feature here in the holy place is this altar of incense. It's described in Exodus 30:1-8. You shall make an altar to burn incense on. You shall make it of acacia wood, again the same wood. 1 cubit shall be its length, and 1 cubit its width. It shall be square, and 2 cubits shall be its height. Its horns shall be 1 piece with it. And you shall overlay its top, its sides, all around, its horns, with pure gold. And you make moldings for it of gold all around. Verse 6, and you shall put it before the veil that is before the ark of the testimony, before the mercy seat that is over the testimony, where I shall meet you. So this was in the holy place, but it was the very last thing before you went into the Holy of Holies. Aaron shall burn on it sweet incense every morning, when he tends the lamps, and shall burn incense on it. And when Aaron lights the lamps at twilight, he shall burn incense on it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations. Now this was a smaller altar than the one that we saw out in the courtyard, and only one thing was to be burned on it, and that was incense. And Aaron did that twice a day. Now no one in the, it was made of a special formula, the incense was, and no one else could use that. In fact, there was a severe penalty if someone tried to copy that formula. The altar was situated at the far end of the room, as we said, directly in front of the veil and the curtain that leads into that holy place. And once a year on the Day of Atonement, we know that the high priest placed blood on the horns of the altar, not the incense, but he actually put blood on the horns of this incense altar to cleanse it. Now we're almost ready to go into the most important room, the Holy of Holies. But between these two rooms, there was a large curtain, a veil, acting as a separation. And here's how God told Moses to make it. This is a artist's rendering of what it may have looked like. He said, you shall make a veil woven of blue, purple, and scarlet, and fine woven linen. It shall be woven with an artistic design of a cherubim. You shall hang it on the four pillars of the acacia wood overlaid with gold. The hook shall be gold upon four sockets of silver. And you shall hang the veil from the clasp. Then you shall bring the ark of the testimony in there behind the veil. The veil shall be a divider for you between the holy place and the most holy, the room that we're just in. So the most holy is another term for the holy of holies. Now we move on to go into the most important room, the holy of holies. Now recall that earlier we said that room was going to be 15 foot square. And there are only two items situated in this room. Before we do that, though, I wondered here, how many people have seen the movie Raiders of the Lost Ark? Or maybe I should ask, is anybody here not seen Raiders of the Lost Ark? John, you've never seen that? You got to watch it. Okay. Anyway, I want to read, if you've seen it, you know the plot of the movie is that there are two groups, and they're desperately searching for the biblical ark. Naturally, one group has some evil intentions, and the other is the goody. And it's in the days leading up to World War II. I want to read a line that was spoken by a character in this movie. His name is Marcus Brody. He's supposed to be a very learned college dean. And this is what he says about the ark in the movie. The Bible speaks of the ark leveling mountains and laying waste to entire regions. An army which carries the ark before it is invincible. So somehow that's what he believed. Is there any place in the Bible that actually says anything like that? Well, the answer is absolutely not. Does the Bible attribute any kind of supernatural power to the ark? Was the ark holy? Well, it was holy as described by God. Notice 2 Chronicles 35:3. It says, "Then he said to the Levites, who taught all Israel, who were holy to the Lord, put the holy ark in the house which the Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel, built." So the ark itself is holy because it's from God. It's attached to God, but it doesn't have any supernatural powers. Now, actually, the entire tabernacle and the furnishings of the entire tabernacle were holy. But as to having supernatural powers, no, it says nothing like that. In fact, the very first time that we read of the ark, it's been removed from the tabernacle. The Bible doesn't comment much on that, but it probably should not have been removed from the tabernacle. And it was carried into battle against the Philistines. And do you remember what happened in that battle? Well, the Philistines beat the Israelites. So this ark, having the ark, which they probably again shouldn't have moved, did not give them supernatural powers. They lost anyway. Now that's a picture from the movie of what they had as a prop for the ark. But surprisingly, it's amazingly accurate as best we can tell. Now here is the actual rendering of the ark, and you see it's actually fairly close in terms of the features of it. Now obviously there wasn't any photos, but again, like other objects in the tabernacle, we have a fairly good description of it. Here's what was given to Moses in Exodus 25:10-14. "And they shall make an ark of acacia wood. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width, and 1.5 cubits its height. And you shall overlay it with pure gold. Inside and out you shall overlay it, and you shall make a molding of gold all around. You shall cast 4 rings of gold for it, and put them in the 4 corners. 2 rings shall be on one side, 2 on the other side. And you shall make poles of acacia wood, and overlay them with gold. And you shall put the poles into the rings on the sides of the ark, that the ark may be carried by them." So no one was supposed to touch the ark or carry the ark without using these poles. Now immediately following the ark, God gives the description of the top part of the ark, which is called the mercy seat. He says in verse 17, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold." There's no acacia wood in this. 2.5 cubits shall be its length, 1.5 cubits its width. "And you shall make 2 cherubim of gold of hammered work, and you shall make them at the 2 ends of the mercy seat." Make one cherub at one end and the other cherub at the other end. You shall make the cherubim at the two ends of it with the mercy seat. And the cherubim shall stretch out their wings, covering the mercy seat with their wings, and they shall face one another. The faces of the cherubim shall be toward the mercy seat. You shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I will give you. Now here's another view of what the ark could have looked like. And as we know, into the Holy of Holies, the high priest is the only one that could go, and that was, again, on the Day of Atonement. Now, the Holy of Holies had another very important purpose. It's delineated or explained in Exodus 25, verse 22. God says, "And there I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim which are on the ark of the testimony, about everything which I will give you in the commandments to the children of Israel." So, how important was this tabernacle to God? Well, notice what he says in Leviticus 26, verse 2. He said, "You shall keep my Sabbaths, and you shall reverence my sanctuary." So he actually includes reverencing the sanctuary in the same sentence with the Sabbath. "I am the Lord." Now, obviously, there's a lot more we could cover about the tabernacle. But in the time remaining, I'd like to show another amazing feature that God incorporated into the structure of this tabernacle. But first, notice what Paul said in Hebrews 9, verse 24. He says, "For Christ is not entered into the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us." So again, let's see the layout of the temple. We're going to go through some examples of what the meaning of this layout. So the tabernacle was used for offerings and a place where God would speak to the Israelites. But it actually pictured the coming salvation that would be made possible by Jesus Christ. So let's quickly go through those features we've talked about and see the symbolism that all points to the work that Jesus Christ and the Father would accomplish for the purpose of salvation. It teaches us that man cannot save himself. So the first feature was the courtyard, again surrounded by linen fence. Was there any significance to this fence? Well, the fence, as a physical barrier, kept people from peering inside to the holy work that the priests were accomplishing. Did that have any specific meaning? Well, in essence, this was symbolic of the world of sin on the outside of the courtyard and the work of salvation that would be possible inside. So the courtyard is actually a kind of a demarcation between the world and between God's work. Now, the next feature was the gate, the doorway, the entrance on the east side of the tabernacle, which was the only way in. Is there any significance to that? Remember, they can only go in through that gate. Well, consider the words of Jesus Christ. In John 10, verse 9, he says, "I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and will go in and out and find pasture." And in John 14, verse 6, he adds, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me." So this gate represented symbolically coming to Jesus Christ, the only way into the courtyard, into the tabernacle, in which we could obtain salvation. Now, what's the next feature? It's the graven altar. The brazen altar, not the graven altar. Does it have any significance in the process of redemption? Well, it's clear this next step that is necessary for salvation was Christ's sacrifice for sin. The altar was where the sacrifices took place. In Philippians 2, verse 8, we read, "And being found in appearance," speaking of Christ, "as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even the death of the cross." And in Hebrews 9, 28, Paul said this, "So Christ was offered once to bear the sins of many. To those who eagerly wait for him, he will appear a second time, apart from sin, for salvation." So the altar standing in the courtyard represents the sacrifice that Jesus Christ made that permitted the sins of all mankind to be covered. So what else is in the courtyard? Well, we have the bronze laver. And what purpose did it serve? Well, the priests had to be washed daily whenever they went in to do their duties. Does it have a significance? Well, it's a cleansing, a washing. And in Romans 6:3 we read, "Or do you not know that as many of us as were baptized into Jesus Christ were baptized into his death? Therefore we were buried with him through baptism into death, just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glory of the Father. Even so we should walk in newness of life." And in 1 Corinthians 6:11 it says, "And such were some of you, but you were washed, you were sanctified, but you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus and by the Spirit of our God." So when we are brought into a right relationship with God, it was through baptism. And the next step in salvation requires us to repent and be baptized into Christ's death, accepting the very sacrifice that he made for us. So this laver pictures the cleansing from sin that results from our personal repentance and baptism. Now we're going to go into the tabernacle building. So symbolically, between the gate and the courtyard, we've accepted Christ and we've been cleansed. But now we can enter into the holy place. Does that have any meaning for us? Well, 1 Peter 2, verse 9 says, "But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, his own special people." So symbolically, the gate and the courtyard, between the gate and the courtyard, we've accepted Christ and we've been cleansed, and now we can enter into the holy place. 1 Peter 2, verse 10 says, "And once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God." So the holy place then represents the New Testament church. And having received God's calling to be a part of his holy family, we're now able to enter into the responsibilities of the priesthood. So what comes after this? Well, we have the candlestick. Does it have any significance? Well, again, in the beginning of John, we read chapter 1 and verse 4, "In him was life, and the life was the light of men," speaking of Christ. So this candlestick represents Christ and his life. Verse 19, "And that was the true light which gives light to every man coming into the world." And Matthew 5:16 says, "Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." So Jesus in us makes us to be a light of the world just as he is. So what else is there? There's one more item, the table of showbread. So that obviously has symbolic meaning too. The bread symbolizes the church, Christ's body, and communion with God. In 1 Corinthians 10, verse 7, Paul says, "For we, though many, are one bread and one body, for we all partake of that one bread." John 6:33 says, "For the bread of God is he who comes down from heaven and gives life to the world." So on this table, there were set 12 loaves each week to be eaten by the priests. And each Sabbath, we come to be fed with God's truth, the word of life, the word of God, and the bread of life. Now we come to the altar of incense, the last feature inside this room. Here's what God told Moses regarding this altar. He said, in Exodus 30, verse 7, "Aaron shall burn sweet incense on it every morning. When he tends the lamp, he shall burn incense on it. And when Aaron lights the lamp at twilight, he shall burn incense on it, a perpetual incense before the Lord throughout your generations." So the incense pictures our prayers going up to God every day. And our prayers should be like this incense, a sweet savor to God. In Revelation 5, verse 8, we have confirmation that it's written by John. "Now when he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints." So recall that that altar was placed just before the veil as you entered into the Holy of Holies. Now next to the altar of incense, again, was this veil. So does it have any significance? Should have gone through that one. There's a depiction of what that veil is between the two rooms. And you recall that only the high priest could go into that room. And on 31 AD, a miraculous event that took place, as you know, at the moment of Christ's death. In Matthew 27:50, we read, "And Christ cried out again with a loud voice as he was being crucified and yielded up his spirit." In verse 51 says, "Behold, the veil of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom, and the earth quaked and the rocks were split." So that veil of the temple in 31 AD was symbolically rent in two. That had an important meaning for us. So this veil being separated was symbolically removing it for access by Christians. And Paul says in Hebrews 10:19, "Therefore, brethren, having boldness to enter the holiest by the blood of Jesus, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need." So through Christ, we have access to the Father now in the Holy of Holies, and it's now possible for converted Christians to come to God himself. Now, the Holy of Holies pictured heaven and God's throne. The way has been made symbolically possible by Christ's sacrifice. And entering into this room symbolically shows that we can now become part of God's family. So inside the ark is used symbolically in the Bible as a type of salvation. And God uses arks in several places to represent salvation, such as Noah's Ark. The mercy seat pictures the very throne of God, as we've read. In 2 Samuel 6:2, it says that God dwells between these cherubim. And notice that the mercy seat also is situated above the ark. Now, inside the ark, as you remember, there were 10 commandments, symbolic of God's law. But God is a God of mercy, and he will extend it to those that have repented and seek him. So, brethren, we've looked today at some of the aspects of the tabernacle. Its design was given to Moses after Sinai, and he even provided the power for individuals to be able to work on it. And after Sinai, Moses went about building it exactly as God has shown. It was completed in the first month of the second year that they had left Egypt. And at that time, God came down in a cloud and entered the tabernacle, showing to the people of Israel that he was with them. And you can read about that in Exodus chapter 40. And today we saw that the very most important features that were included in the tabernacle, and additionally we've seen that it portrayed the future work that Jesus Christ would do in bringing salvation to mankind. Now, there's actually a whole lot more details that are in these verses, in these chapters, that we didn't go into, certainly didn't have time. But you may want to go back and read some of those chapters and get some of those details in the latter half of the book of Exodus. So, brethren, I hope this has been informative and edifying, and I hope you have a great remainder of the Sabbath.